And parents and adults in general, if you want to turn to Joshua chapter 2 this morning, Joshua chapter 2. We're continuing our series on Joshua. We've been talking about promises, identity, and purpose, the things that are being spelled out for the people of God as they are moving into the promised land. Some reminders in some of these things, but also some new assignments that are given to them. And today, as we look in Joshua chapter 2, we're looking at Rahab, a prostitute used by God to rescue the spies of Israel, also used by God in a really powerful way. She appears again and again throughout the history of Scripture. Though she had been a prostitute, a temple prostitute, she ends up in the lineage of Jesus as the mother of Boaz. She's pictured throughout the end of the Scriptures as a person of great faith and someone that should be emulated, not for her prostitution, obviously, but for her great faith. And but she is a Canaanite woman, and she is so she has come from a pagan people. And when I say pagan, I don't just simply mean that they don't know the Lord. I mean that she is part of a culture in which there are many, many gods. And the likelihood is, as we look at the description of her and we discover little bits about her life, is she's still very connected to her family, connected to society, not being shunned, that we're talking about a culture where this the form of prostitution that she's participating in is a part of normal society, respected. She's not in the shadows. She's part of their religious expression. And in the midst of that, she has come to know who God is and even identifies him by his personal name and speaks of God, not in the general sense of God. There are many gods to the Canaanites. They were very familiar with the term El and El Elyon and other names for God. But this time she uses the personal name of God, Yahweh, identifies him from every other god in their pantheon of gods and makes some really distinct statements about who God is and who the people of God are, very powerful, and ultimately takes this woman who is not destitute, who is not a shut out of society, and yet because of her understanding of who God is, will, if you will, sell out her city to side with God and the people of God. And we have to ask the question, why, when no one else in the city did? For that reason, let's take a look at Joshua chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Please read along in whatever translation's on your lap. It's my favorite one. And we will see what Joshua chapter 2 says. And Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go, view the land, especially Jericho." And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab, and they lodged there. And it was told to the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out these men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them, and she said, "True, the men came to me, but I did not know who they were or where they were from. And when the gate was about to close at dark, the men went out. I did not know who these men were. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." But she had brought them up onto her roof and hidden them with stalks of flax that she had laid there in order on the roof. So the men pursued after on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords, and the gates were shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, "I know that Yahweh has given you the land and that the fear of you has fallen upon us and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how Yahweh dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came in out of the land of Egypt and how what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Shihon and to Og, whom were devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard of it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you, for Yahweh your God. He is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now then, please swear to me by Yahweh that as I have dealt kindly with you, you will also deal kindly with my father's house and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and mother and my brothers and sisters and all who belong to them and deliver our lives from death. And the men said to her, our lives for yours, even to death. If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. She let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the city wall so that she lived in the wall. And she said to them, go into the hills or the pursuers will encounter you and hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Then afterward, you may go your way. And the men said to her, we will be guiltless with respect to this oath of ours that you made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, you shall tie the scarlet cord in the window so that of which you let us down, and you shall gather into your house your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household. Then if anyone goes out of the doors of your house into the street, then his blood shall be upon his own head, and we shall be guiltless. But if a hand is laid on any one of you who is in this house, his blood shall be on our head. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be guiltless with respect to the oath that you made us swear. And she said, according to your words, so be it. Then she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and went into the hills and remained there 3 days until the pursuers returned. The pursuers reached all along the way and found nothing. Then the two men returned, and they came down from the hills and passed over and came to Joshua, son of Nun. And they told him all that happened to them. And they said to Joshua, truly, Yahweh has given us all the land into our hands, and also all the inhabitants of the land who melt away because of us. Now, isn't it fascinating, the short memory that Israel has versus the memory of all the people in the lands around them? It always amazes me. It shouldn't by now. You would think I would be used to it by now, but I'm constantly amazed that when God does things for us, how short our memory is of those things. And yet, whenever doom and disaster are coming our way, that well, we can't seem to forget those things. Do you know what I'm talking about? Whenever a team is going up against another team, maybe you have a young football team or something, they've won a bunch of games, and they're going for the championship, suddenly they get into the game and they just melt away because, man, they are facing some big, mighty team with lots of experience, and they completely forget who they are, Baylor. They completely forget who they are when they're most being counted on. Golly. And but there seems to be this nature within us of that when God does things in our lives and in our hearts, that we are quick to forget. We can remember that Elijah is, he was blessed by the Lord and defeated the prophets of Baal and defeated 450 prophets, and he runs away, and he runs over to the queen, and he tells her the, you know, what God says, and he tells the king what God says, and then she says, well, I'm going to pursue you to your death. And he immediately faints away and completely loses all of his heart. We see it over and over again in Scripture, and it's true that once people just hear those things, that they begin to just listen to that negative press, and they quickly forget who God is in their lives and what God has done for them. Do you ever forget what God has done for you when the chips are down, when things get difficult, when life is pressing and crushing and threatening and empty threats are being spoken against you? The Jezebel has spoken and said, they're going to destroy you. They're going to make waste of you. And quickly we forget who God is and what he's done in our lives. It's amazing how quickly we forget. Now, the Canaanites have been waiting for them for 40 years. I think that's a significant memory, don't you? They're talking about what happened 40 years earlier at the Red Sea, and they remember it just like it was yesterday. And they're saying, you know those guys? Did you hear what they did when they got to the towns as they were getting ready to come into the land that God promised them? Did you hear what God has been doing on their behalf? You see, 40 years is not a big deal when you don't live in the information age and everything's instant. They lived in a day and age in which things didn't change very rapidly. In fact, I come to think about things. The other day I was watching a movie from the 1980s, and I watched a movie from the 1960s, and I watched a movie from the 1940s, all in pretty close succession. And you know what I noticed? The technology was pretty much the same from 1940 to 1960 to 1980. And then all of a sudden you walk into our day and age and everything is, it happens so fast. we can't believe that 40 years isn't that long. See, to us, that's a long time ago. But to them, it was really recent history. And they are pressed by this. They are crushed by this. And they know of a very powerful God, a God who is different than any other God in the of the peoples around them. And here's the distinguishing thing. It happened in the land of Egypt. Now, when you think of the land of Egypt, you've got to think world superpower. I know it doesn't seem that way today, but there was a time in which Egypt was the most powerful nation on earth. That was that day. Egypt was powerful. They had no question that they were able to crush them. In fact, here's the thing, that the history of Egypt is that they would regularly come to the land of Canaan and crush them. And they lived in a world that was completely supernatural in their minds. They worshiped the river, the Nile River. And they had good reason in their minds, because that was where they got their crops from, is why they had water and they had crops when nobody else did. The Canaanites had to go to the Egyptians whenever they were having famine in the land and buy their goods and services from them, because they're the only ones who had food in the land. And so they have all these reasons to be intimidated by Egypt. They're powerful. They have mighty gods. They have a mighty river. And this God that we've never heard of, Yahweh, a God of this little group of people called the Hebrews who've been slaves, comes virtually out of nowhere and absolutely stomps the living daylights out of the most powerful nation on earth without them ever lifting a finger. They weren't ready for battle. They were up against the sea. They should have been destroyed. And this God, Yahweh, he devastated the nation of Egypt. They're afraid. But so's Israel. Isn't it amazing how quickly we forget what God does on our behalf? But they haven't forgotten. In fact, they've been playing a game of telephone. You know what the game of telephone is, don't you? That's where you tell one person, they tell one person. And as it goes, the story completely morphs. Isn't it amazing how much bigger the fish gets as the story goes? And can you imagine 40 years of oral tradition, also known as old wives' tales? I don't know what, you know, I'm sure they were really young, pretty women. But 40 years of stories of people talking about what happened back then. I'm imagining by now it wasn't just frogs that came out of the water. It was vampire frogs that came up and sucked the life out of people. They were giant. They were huge people. The stories have got to be phenomenal by now. And they are shaking in their boots, afraid, just like Israel. It's amazing, isn't it? And so these two spies come into the land, and they're staking things out. They're wondering what's going to happen. And as these people are waiting for them to show up, they're on the lookout. They've already heard about what has happened on the other side of the Jordan. So if they had any wonder if this God was still up to it, he has more than proven his point that he is able. And then they're still afraid. Why is it that a temple prostitute has more faith in God than Israel? Isn't it ironic? I mean, the thing that seems so incredulous about the whole account is not the miraculous things that happen. It's that the people of Yahweh are sitting in Shittim afraid, and that this temple prostitute has more faith than they do for what God can do. Now, I'll grant you this. I bet that the Lord had his hand in it. You know, I'm amazed. One of the things that always intrigues me is stories of battle come up, that many times how the Lord will send angels and they will whisper among the people and remind them of stories, and the people will be afraid and run away even before things happen. Sometimes angels would come in and terrorize the camp of their enemies long before their army ever arrived and they got there to an empty battlefield. And so I have no doubt that God has his messengers probably going on the land and saying, hey, remember who these people are. Watch out. You're going to die. I have no doubt that there was great fear in the land and that God had his hand in that fear. But let me ask you something. What's it like when you come to the battlefield and the armies of your enemies are ready to give up before you even step on the field? I mean, you know, I played sports growing up, and I can remember there was that kid that was like, had won all kinds of state championships and things like that. And the minute he would get into the kickboxing ring, man, immediately, like half the people would just quit before they ever got into the fight. They just heard these rumors of how awesome he was. And I remember the day I watched a kid take him down really quick. And I was like, well, he isn't so awesome. You see, I had to see that takedown to realize that he wasn't as amazing as he had grown to be in my mind. There's something about when you walk onto the battlefield with a sense of confidence and who you are and your abilities, and there's something so defeating when we walk into the battlefield, whether it's just simply sitting down to a game of chess, or it's competing in a state competition and in athletics, or whether it's an athletic competition and doing debate or whatever else, or politics, you name it, that when the moment that we think that the stakes are stacked against us, we usually believe everybody else's press. Isn't it amazing? And so God's maybe preparing the field in that way, helping to bolster them. He's already told them, be strong and courageous in chapter 1. Chapter 2, they're already somewhat of fear more than faith. And now a temple prostitute becomes a prophetess to the people of God. And when they return, what do they say? Do they go back and they say, you know, Yahweh God, the mighty God, our God, told us that we're going to take the land. Let's go take the land. No, they come back and they said, hey, everybody says, okay, lesson number one. Whenever somebody says to you, everybody, remember, one person said. It's right here in scripture, it's true in life. Anytime I hear somebody say, everybody says, is the moment I don't believe you. You want to sway me? Tell me the names of people and the times and the events. Otherwise, when you say everybody says, I just go, pfft. In other words, nobody said but you, and you're trying to make a strong argument out of a weak argument. Everybody says. What do they come back and say? Everybody, no, one temple prostitute said. But they come back and they're like, you know, God tells them, I'm going to do all these, just like I did in Egypt. I'm going to do just like I did in these cities. I'm going to do for you. And they're like, okay, God, if you say so. They visit one temple prostitute and they come back and they're like, yeah, buddy, we're going to whoop them now. I don't know if it's just because they're guys and they went to see, you know. Gosh, that'd be really sad if that's the case, isn't it? And yet, here the reality is that she becomes the prophetess that speaks the words that bolsters the army, that sends them ready to take on Jericho and the lands around it. And you know, God has this way of revealing himself sometimes in the most unexpected places, doesn't he? I'm always, my heart is captured whenever I see God's mercy to a person who is a long way off from him. They don't know him, they have no understanding of him, and I will see God's mercy come upon their lives, his kindness come upon their lives, and I'm reminded that the rain falls on the just and the unjust. You see, my God is merciful like that. He loves people. He loves people so much that he said to those who were afar off, I will give my son, not because I hate the world, irritated with it, frustrated with it, but because God so loved the world, he would send his son. So God feeds the pagan and the Christian. God loves Nineveh enough that even though Nineveh is the vilest nation of their time, that he would send Nineveh a prophet named Jonah, even against Jonah's own desire. And why didn't Jonah want to go? I know you, God. You're the God of loving kindness. You're the God of mercy. And I won't get my pound of flesh if you send me there. They'll repent. They'll change their hearts. God loved the Gentiles enough. That's you and me if you've forgotten. That he would send us the Apostle Paul to tell us the message that even those who are afar off get to come in. Even the heavens themselves declare the goodness of God, the scriptures promise us. God reveals himself in some of the most unexpected ways, the most unexpected times, and through some of the most unexpected people. So it really shouldn't be a surprise that Rahab, a temple prostitute, would tell the people of God about his great wonders, about his might. You know, one of the things I love about Rahab is that how God uses her not only this time, but later on throughout the Bible, she comes up again and again. Do you know that she is in the lineage of Jesus? In other words, not only is she not Jewish, not only is she a pagan from a Canaanite religion, not only was she a prostitute, but she's in the lineage of Jesus. She is part of the hope of God's plan for the hope of the world, even after God had said, don't marry those other people and different things. See, it wasn't about segregation or racism. It was his way of preserving a bloodline and a story. But it was never an excuse for racism or shutting people out. Israel was called to be the hope of the nations, a light unto the world. Abraham was told that his offspring, not just in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, was told that they would, that his offspring would be a blessing to all people. You see, God's heart was always for the nations. So it shouldn't really be that big of a surprise, but somehow it takes us off guard. Somehow we've forgotten that there is grace and mercy in the Old Testament. And Rahab says something very peculiar to them. Not only does she identify Yahweh God as distinct from all the other gods and put and declare her faith in him, make statements about the fact that he is God of all the nations, God of all the universe, but then she does something so peculiar. She says, hesed. We don't have an equivalent for it in the English. We most often, if we translate it in the Old Testament, as God's loving kindness, but we really have no equivalent. Some people have tried to make an equivalent out of agape in the Greek and things like that, but you know, the truth is there's just no equivalent for the word hesed. It's lost on us in the English, sadly. There's actually multiple words that we use to translate it, among them loving kindness, steadfastness, mercy, love, kindness. It is the character and the nature of relationship between God and his people that he loves them hesed. He is for them hesed. He has relationship with them hesed. It is a covenant kind of belonging and connectedness and mercy and love and kindness that has no other descriptors that in English that come anywhere close or any other language. It is a unique word to the Hebrew, hesed. And it's God's special way of dealing with his people. And she, in the midst of all of this, looks at them and she said, she didn't just say, I did a kindness to you. She said, what I did for you was hesed. And in that moment, they declare their lives to her because they understand that there's something about the nature of how God deals with his people and covenant, what God is willing to do for his people, hesed, that now that they are bound to her in a way that is not just because of kindness, not just because of she called upon them in covenant. She identified and she said, that God, Yahweh, that particular God who is God of all nations, God of all peoples, that God, that's why I did it. Hesed. It's not just you owe me. It's that I have declared my confidence in him. I have staked my life, my hope, my everything in him. And now we are in covenant. She is, if you will, a Canaanite convert to Judaism in that moment. She has declared, she has staked her claim, she is banking everything in her, everything outside on the fact that God is who he said he was, and she makes greater statement of faith than Israel has made in their entire existence up to this point. I am willing to turn my back on everything I know, hesed. You take me with you. You make me one of your people. And we follow her storyline. And by the time we get to Hebrews chapter 11, she's listed among those who are the heroes of the faith. There's not that many in chapter 11. You can count them. And she's one of the ones listed as a hero of the faith. In James, she's talked about in the context of Abraham, compared only with Abraham. Who else gets compared with Abraham? Not even Moses. And it gives her as an example of what it means to have faith and action. When he says, show me your faith by your deeds. In that context, when it talks about Abraham being the father of faith, the example of the female is who? Rahab, a prostitute. Not of the right family line, not because she got her life all cleaned up, not because she had done anything spectacular or anything else up to that point, but because she staked her life on the covenant, mercy, loving kindness of God, on Hesed, and she said, based on that, she put everything in. And for that reason, oh, she did lots of other things. But in Hebrews and in James, the only reason it gives is because of this moment. You see, she had such confidence in who God was and how he treats people that she threw her life on the Hesed of God, believing that his Hesed would cover the sin of prostitution, that his Hesed had covered the sin of Israel, that his Hesed fulfills promise, that his Hesed makes a way even for those who are far off. And you know what? We're not in the New Testament, people. This is Old Testament. So that when the Apostle Paul went out proclaiming the goodness of God and the mercy of God, he proclaimed the Hesed, the agape of God to a people, and he preached the good news of Jesus Christ. The New Testament hadn't been written. The Old Testament is full of grace and mercy. And if you don't see it, it's because you're not reading it. It wasn't because of her sacrifice. It was because of who she put her trust in when she made the sacrifice. She was ultimately depending on the loving kindness of God because there was nothing she had done to deserve it. See, if she hadn't mentioned Hesed, they could have walked out. They could have said, good luck to you, you better run. But they didn't. She said Hesed. And a Gentile woman who had been a prostitute ends up in the family lineage of Jesus. And we're reminded that mercy triumphs over judgment. It ought to capture our hearts. And you know, the thing is that all of that hope, all that hope was based on the evidence that she'd seen. She'd never read the Bible. She's had no significant connection with the Israelites. But from the evidence she's seen about what this God is like, this Canaanite Gentile woman ends up in the lineage of Jesus and reminds us that the God who is the same yesterday, today, and forever was the same God who covered her sin because of his great love. You know what the New Testament teaches? It teaches very clearly that Jesus, in chapter 10 of Hebrews, it says, Jesus made one sacrifice one time for all time's sake. You see, even the blood in the temple, her forgiveness, your forgiveness and mine, and the forgiveness of those who will be after us, was all banked on this, that what Jesus did for us in forgiving us our sin. And the only reason the Old Testament people got forgiven, and the only reason the New Testament people got forgiven, and the only reason that you and I get forgiven, is because of his loving kindness. That he would give his son to die for us. So Rahab got it. She staked her claim with the Lord. She embraced her promise. She staked her life in God. She got a new identity, became an icon of faith, not because she was born in the right family, not because she had it all together, not because she was so righteous or pure, but simply by putting her hope in God's chesed. You see, usually when we go to the book of Joshua, what we're looking for is how God's people got to kick butt. I know we don't like the vernacular, but let's be honest. That's what they're all raving. They can't wait. And when we get into Joshua, usually the big emphasis is how powerful God is and he can defeat all of our enemies. And that's true. But the most important part of chapter 2 is that Rahab found mercy. That Rahab reminds us that even in the Old Testament, God was looking for us Gentiles to know of his great loving kindness and to be in relationship with him. You see, the sad thing is that everyone in the land had they could have known and worshiped the true and living God. At that moment, you would think that many people would have bowed down and said, this God must be the real God. But they didn't in Egypt. They didn't in Canaan. And you know, the history of God's people continually as they came up against their enemy was not of people bowing down and recognizing whose God was truly God, but them saying, yeah, well, we'll fight to the death about it. Maybe that's true in your life even now. Maybe right now, even as we look at these things and we find fault with the people of Israel, we find fault with things that we don't like in the Bible or whatever else, and despite the fact that we've heard of the loving kindness of God and his mercy and his continual chesed, his loving kindness to us, that we fight him, that we push against all these other things, that we try to make our own way, that we try to do it by the strength of our own hand, and continually the message is there. One of loving kindness. Not because we earned it, not because we deserved it, but even when we're afar off, he makes a way. Let's stand together.